This week, we unravel the traditional story of Genesis in a perspective that makes man the custodian of God's new temple, the human body. Then, we take a look at an excerpt from Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man. What does he say about the French Declaration of Rights? Find out right now.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, welcome back. This is episode number 449. I want to thank everybody for tuning in once more. Give a big shout out goes to the supporters, the fellows, the contributors, producers of the WCY podcast. Again, we can't do this without you guys, and I really appreciate those of you who have decided to sign up and become patrons of the show, whether through PayPal or Patreon, in light of the current pandemic and our foregoing of any adverts for this time. So, again, thank you to all of you. As you heard in the opening, we've got a great show. I've got a couple of things for you, and I hope you guys really enjoy. We're going to present some information that, of course, as always, is not something that I view as sacrosanct, or I'm not getting on my soapbox or giving a stump speech. I would like to, as always, present information that is for your contemplation, for our conversations, and perhaps it will enable you to have further conversations in your own lodges or your Zoom conferences or whatever you're having in the future here to just bring about further growth. In the news, of course, it's hard to go anywhere, turn on anything, even Facebook scrolling, without finding much of the content related to the unrest around the world in relation to the death of Mr. Floyd. We've got many Grand Lodges out there who are starting to make statements. I think the first was the Grand Lodge of D.C. The Grand Lodge of D.C. and the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of D.C. decided to put out a joint statement, which I found very powerful. And the next one I saw actually came from the Most Worshipful Prince Hall Grand Lodge of the state of Illinois. And that, again, was another very powerful statement. And I commend our Grand Masters for doing all that they're doing and extend my support to you. And just know that whatever I can do to assist in the good works, let me know and we're all in. We are Freemasons, of course, first and foremost, and have a duty to spread that cement. And hopefully that extends into our communities and humanity as a whole. So whatever we can do, I just want to tell our listeners, listen, we got to be Freemasons. We have to be upstanding. We have to be the examples as always, and now more than ever. It may be said a little too often that Freemasonry is needed now more than ever before. And it's kind of a tired platitude. But when we think about it, it's true. So the first piece I have for you this week, actually, is something I received quite a long time ago, almost 8 months ago. And it's by a friend of mine, Mark McSweeney, who's actually a member over in Germany, in Wiesbaden, Germany, Lodge number 838. Luftbrook? Maybe I'm saying that correctly. I hope I am. Brother Mark, thank you again for allowing me to read this on the program. And I hope all of our listeners really enjoy it. Let's go ahead and get into this one right now. Genesis 1:3, God's Temple Erected, Dedicated, and Defiled, by Brother Mark McSweeney. The Standard View. The common Western viewpoint of the biblical creation account inherited from the Protestant Reformation and subsequent evangelical traditions is a product of several factors. For one, it rejects myth, allegory, and metaphor as a veiled literary technique, which inevitably leads to a cartoonish literal interpretation. Second, this viewpoint heavily depends on modern rationalism, whereby people see the account through the eyes of materialism and modern scientific inquiry. This leads to the idea that the Genesis contains a scientific step-by-step account of how God created the world. Thirdly, the modern creation view filters the account through a reformed penal mentality, whereby the account becomes a story of sin and judgment. The reformers, influenced by St. Augustine, believed in Adamic guilt, or Adamic guilt, whereby each person born bears the same guilt as Adam. Humans were created in a perfect, godlike state from which they, quote-unquote, fell. Reformed theologians speak of mankind being in a covenant of works, whereby their eternal life was dependent upon moral perfection. God then planted the tree of knowledge of good and evil in order to test man's obedience. They disobeyed, sin entered the world, and that sin spread to every person. In summary, Genesis 1:3 is a story of the origin of the physical universe and of sin. Doubts about the standard view. I was never satisfied with the conventional view of Genesis and loathed having to teach it. I drew some comfort from C.S. Lewis, who believed there was mythic elements to it, but this never informed me of how I should approach the story. I was still missing the key to unlock the passage. The standard view had many problems, and it was starting to unravel in my mind. For one, there was the toxic view of man, being branded as sinners from the womb. There was nothing in the text which indicated that any kind of sin or sin nature was handed down generationally, nor was this some kind of account of the beginning of sin. In fact, the very next story in the Bible, Cain and Abel, indicates that Cain was not automatically under the power of sin, but had the ability to master it. The Apostle Paul, in referring to the Genesis story, taught that we inherited mortality from Adam. Another problem is that of the serpent creature in the story. God declares the creation very good, yet this creature is present in the Garden of Eden from the start. Where did he come from? And why is he there? How can the creation be called good when there is a devil present? Still, another problem is the common idea of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. We get the impression that the text that the fruit was genuinely bad for humans and not just some kind of test. According to the standard view, however, the nature of this tree is irrelevant. God could just have easily commanded Adam and Eve not to stand on one leg for more than 10 minutes. Besides, why is knowledge wrong? Why forbid knowledge and wisdom? Lastly, the overtly unscientific views of my ministry friends and colleagues was beginning to bother me. I felt that it was unrealistic to expect Genesis to contain any science at all. The whole interpretation of Genesis 1:3 seemed anachronistic to me. A fresh look. In recent history, much literature had been discovered that sheds light on the mindset and beliefs of the people of the ancient Near East. We are now able to compare the Bible to other literature of the same time and place. I stumbled across the writings of John Walton, an Old Testament scholar. I owe much of what follows to him. In reality, Genesis 1:2 is a story about God setting up and dedicating a cosmic temple. The center of the temple was on planet Earth, which was to serve as a center of his government. All literature of the ancient Near East, including the Bible, is concerned about the struggle between order and chaos. In the biblical creation story, the natural state of affairs was disorder, to which God brought order and called it good. In ancient iconography, serpents were viewed as agents of chaos. This chaos is introduced in Genesis 3. The story begins with God arranging heaven and earth into a certain order. The first 3 days have to do with God preparing space, while the second period of 3 have to do with Him filling it. Because man was created last, he is the focal point of the whole creation. Man, male and female, was created in God's image, which expresses function, not capability. God tasked man to superintend creation. Most ancient temples' precincts are divided into 3 parts. Moving from the outside to the inside, there is the outer court, the outer sanctuary, and the inner sanctuary. Access to the sanctuaries, especially the inner sanctuary, was restricted. In the Bible, we find this tripartite division on Mount Sinai, in the wilderness tabernacle, in the Temple of Solomon, and in man himself, who is the temple of God. How do we know that God's creation was tripartite? This is where Eden comes along. Many people assume that the whole point was to be in Eden, and that Eden was all that existed. The biblical text itself contradicts this. Man was to multiply and fill the earth, and therefore could not possibly have remained in Eden. It was obviously not God's plan for everyone to be in Eden, nor could they all fit inside. The Bible finished setting up the temple, he moved in, and took up residence. This is the basic thought of the seventh day of creation. In ancient thinking, gardens are special places of beauty, often connected to kings' palaces. The difference between a garden and a wilderness is not in the contents, for they are often the same, but rather in order and harmony. A garden is an ordered paradise that belongs to the king. In ancient iconography, the residence of the gods was often portrayed as being a garden on a mountaintop, examples being Mount Olympus, or surrounded by fertile rivers. The biblical creation account uses all three of these metaphors. One last crucial element remains. Ancient temples were dedicated to a particular god or goddess, whose image was in the inner sanctuary. In the biblical account, God creates Eden and places man, who is made in his image, in the inner sanctuary. There can be no greater honor bestowed upon man, and this shows his importance, worth, and dignity. If Eden is the inner sanctuary and Adam was placed there, it logically follows that he served there as a priest. In fact, this is what the Bible actually says. Quote, "The Lord God took man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it." End quote. Genesis 2:15. Both Hebrew terms are used elsewhere for the duties of the priests. Adam was tasked with taking care of sacred space. This also raises the possibility of there being humans who do not have access to sacred space. Clearly, not every person could have served in Eden. This is also perhaps a solution to a perplexing problem, which is an apparent contradiction between the two creation accounts of Genesis 1 and 2. Genesis 1 regards the creation and human race as a whole, while Genesis 2 is specific to Eden and those who serve there. Eden is the inner sanctuary, and the rest of the earth is the outer sanctuary. This is no disservice to the rest of humanity, for all are made in God's image. What about the serpent in the garden? If the garden was sacred space, how does he fit in? The noun form of nakash is often translated as snake, but this is clearly not a literal snake. The verb form, nakash, means to deceive, while the adjectival form means shining one. Elsewhere in the Bible, the serpent is identified as one of the cherubim, a type of angelic being which guards God's throne. Two cherubim were placed on the Ark of the Covenant, which symbolized the seat or chair of God's government. The Ark itself was placed in the Holy of Holies. A cherubim with a flaming sword guards access to Eden. Regardless of one's view of this serpent, the devil, etc., it is an inescapable conclusion that he belonged there, regardless of his moral leanings or intentions regarding humankind. There is one last thing to be dealt with, and that is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The tree of life is self-explanatory, allowing those who eat of it to live forever. The other tree, however, is more problematic. If the tree represents moral understanding, how can Adam and Eve know what that is before they eat it? Furthermore, it seems cruel of God to place it in the garden to tempt Adam. I then had an interesting idea. What if God placed it there precisely because man would eventually be allowed to eat it? Maybe the task of mankind was not to be morally perfect, but rather to learn and develop. If my 7-year-old daughter takes my car keys and goes for a ride, I would have to enact severe consequences. If she does the same thing 10 years from now, that would be totally normal. The concept of moral development saves God from being a monster and makes perfect sense of the text. The very term, knowledge of good and evil, is a Hebraism expressing maturity. Adam and Eve took something for which they were not yet prepared for. The fruit is linked to wisdom in the context, and wisdom could be a code word for esoteric knowledge. Putting it all together, Adam and Eve failed to follow protocol and profaning sacred space. The fruit was God's to give and not theirs to take. Genesis 1:3 is not primarily a story about the origin of sin, but rather of the creation and defiling of sacred space. It would appear that the temples made by man later on harken back to this original cosmic temple and the cosmic order that it represented. Conclusion. What does this all mean about me becoming open to Freemasonry? I feel somewhat ashamed to speak of it, since my ideas do not necessarily correspond accurately to the craft, nor is my knowledge as an Enter de Pregis complete, far from it. However, there were certain thought processes in my mind, and several obstacles were removed. 1. In learning about Freemasonry through various means, including the WCY podcast, I had an aha moment when I heard a reference to the Heavenly or Cosmic Lodge. I also remembered seeing a photo of the ceiling of the United Grand Lodge of England in London, which was decorated with various heavenly bodies. It seemed reasonable to me that the lodges are patterned after the original Cosmic Lodge. Suddenly, what seemed strange and pagan to me was biblical. 2. The value of man is clear in the biblical text, and the Masonic principles, brotherly love, the brotherhood of man, etc., seemed to correspond well to it. When confronted with the unknown, I had a litmus test, which was how we view our fellow man. 3. Writers such as Manly P. Hall have often mentioned a two-track method of the ancient mysteries, greater and lesser mysteries, etc. It was difficult for me to understand how there could be two systems, and why there needs to be secrets. Why not be open and have just one? One passage in the Gospels which I have tried to explain away for decades was where Jesus quote-unquote hid certain things from the public using parables. Now I could no longer ignore that. In Genesis 1:3, there seemed to be two kinds of people, those who were in Eden and those who weren't. This gave me the framework to accept a two-track system without having to look down upon or denigrate the profane. 4. My new understanding of the tree of knowledge of good and evil helped me be friendly to esoteric truths, providing, of course, that connection is valid. Where there is a temple, there is a priesthood. Where there is a priesthood, there are mysteries. 5. It seems evident from the Bible that access to sacred space was temporarily cut off, but was reinstated in a more limited way with the Temple of Solomon. However, I was often baffled and intrigued with the connections of some of the biblical characters with various quote-unquote pagan priesthoods. Abraham paid homage to the Canaanite priest Melchizedek. Joseph married into an Egyptian priestly family, and Moses got the double whammy. He grew up in the Egyptian court, thereby learning the Egyptian mysteries, and later married into the Midian priesthood. In fact, his father-in-law was instrumental in the political and judicial structure of Israel. All this broadened my outlook and opened up my perspective. So goes the mental transformation that led me to seek admittance to the lodge. I am glad to have done so. That concludes the paper from Mark McSweeney, who I believe is now a Master Mason. This was a paper that he wrote, as you can tell, before he became a Freemason, explaining some of the thoughts, and then after becoming an Entered Apprentice, it all coming together. And I just love the paper. You know, sometimes I read something that is not strictly Masonic. It's more dealing with the mysteries of mankind. And necessarily, this runs into the mysteries of religions and philosophies and spiritualism, these different kinds of concepts, because it's all related to the truth, with a capital T, truth. And so I hope that that paper assisted you in kind of understanding why he came in, a really great perspective. And also, I think the mysteries in some of the academics that he presented in the paper and his aha moments maybe triggered something in you to go pull a book off the shelf and dig in. So next up, I have a reading that I would love to do for you, and I'll be reading from my personal copy of The Rights of Man by Thomas Paine. This is just an excerpt, and I can't recommend the book enough. It's probably one of my top 10 favorite books of all time. Regardless of philosophical content, fiction or science fiction or whatever, it's probably in the top 10 if I mixed all the categories of books I read together. It's always in there. And I wanted to read this short excerpt for your consideration and also to assist us in thinking about some of these concepts. Now, I don't agree with everything in this text, Again, this is Thomas Paine, The Rights of Man. Collector's Edition, Easton Press, Norwalk, Connecticut. Original publish date, Part 1, 1791. Part 2, 1792. Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizens by the National Assembly of France. The representatives of the people of France, formed into a national assembly considering that ignorance, neglect, or contempt of human rights are the sole causes of public misfortunes and corruption of government, have resolved to set forth in solemn declaration these natural, imprescriptible, and inalienable rights, that this declaration being constantly present to the minds of members of the body social, they may be forever kept attentive to the rights and their duties, that the acts of the legislative and executive powers of government, being capable of being every moment compared with the end of political institutions, may be more respected, and also that the future claims of the citizens, being directed by simple and incontestable principles, may always tend to the maintenance of the Constitution and the general happiness. For these reasons, the National Assembly doth recognize and declare in the presence of the Supreme Being and with the hope of His blessing and favor the following sacred rights of men and of citizens. 1. Men are born and always continue free and equal in respect of their rights. Civil distinctions, therefore, can be founded only on public utility. 2. The end of all political associations is the preservation of the natural and imprescriptible rights of man. And these rights are liberty, property, security, and resistance of oppression. 3. The nation is essentially the source of all sovereignty, nor can any individual or any body of men be entitled to any authority which is not expressly derived from it. 4. Political liberty consists in the power of doing whatever does not injure another. The exercise of the natural rights of every man has no other limits than those which are necessary to secure to every other man the free exercise of the same rights, and these limits are determinable only by the law. 5. The law ought to prohibit only actions hurtful to society. What is not prohibited by the law should not be hindered, nor should anyone be compelled to that which the law does not require. 6. The law is an expression of the will of the community. All citizens have a right to concur, either personally or by their representatives, in its formation. It should be the same to all, whether it protects or punishes, and all, being equal in its sight, are equally eligible to all honors, places, and employments, according to their different abilities, without any other distinction than that created by their virtue and talents. 7. No man should be accused, arrested, or held in confinement except in cases determined by the law, and according to the forms which it has prescribed. All who promote, solicit, execute, or cause to be executed arbitrary orders ought to be punished, and every citizen called upon or apprehended by virtue of the law ought immediately to obey, and renders himself culpable by resistance. 8. The law ought to impose no other penalties but such as are absolutely and evidently necessary, and no one ought to be punished, but in virtue of a law promulgated before the offense and legally applied. 9. Every man being presumed innocent till he has been convicted, whenever his detention becomes indispensable, all rigor to him, more than is necessary to secure his person, ought to be provided against by the law. 10. No man ought to be molested on account of his opinions, not even on account of his religious opinions, provided his avowal of them does not disturb the public order established by the law. 11. The unrestrained communication of thoughts and opinions being one of the most precious rights of man, every citizen may speak, write, and publish freely, provided he is responsible for the abuse of this liberty in cases determined by the law. 12. A public force being necessary to give security to the rights of men and of citizens, that force is instituted for the benefit of the community and not for the particular benefit of the person to whom it is entrusted. 13. A common contribution being necessary for the support of the public force and for defraying the other expenses of government, it ought to be divided equally among the members of the community according to their ability. 14. Every citizen has a right, either by himself or his representative, to a free voice in determining the necessity of public contributions, the appropriation of them and their amount, mode of assessment, and duration. 15. Every community has a right to demand of all its agents an account of their conduct. 16. Every community in which a separation of powers and security of rights is not provided for wants a constitution. 17. The right to property, being inviolable and sacred, no one ought to be deprived of it except in cases of evident public necessity legally ascertained and on condition of a previous just indemnity. Thomas Paine's Observations on the Declaration of Rights. The first three articles comprehend in general terms the whole of the Declaration of Rights. All the succeeding articles either originate from them or follow as elucidations. The fourth, fifth, and sixth define more particularly what is only generally expressed in the first, second, and third. The seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, and eleventh articles are declaratory of principles upon which laws shall be constructed, conformable to rights already declared. But it is questioned by some very good people in France, as well as in other countries, whether the tenth article sufficiently guarantees the right it is intended to accord with, besides which it takes off from the divine dignity of religion and weakens its operative force upon the mind to make it a subject of human laws. It then presents itself to man like a light intercepted by a cloudy medium in which the source of it is obscured from his sight, and he sees nothing to reverence in the dusky ray. The remaining articles, beginning with the 12th, are substantially contained in the principles of the preceding articles, but in the particular situation in which France then was, having to undo what was wrong as well as to set up what was right, it was proper to be more particular than what in another condition of things would be necessary. While the Declaration of Rights was before the National Assembly, some of its members remarked that if a Declaration of Rights were published, it should be accompanied by a Declaration of Duties. The observation discovered a mind that reflected, and it only erred by not reflecting far enough. A Declaration of Rights is, by reciprocity, a Declaration of Duties also. Whatever is my right as a man is also the right of another, and it becomes my duty to guarantee as well as to possess. The three first articles are the base of liberty, as well individual as national. Nor can any country be called free whose government does not take its beginning from the principles they contain and continue to preserve them pure, and the whole of the Declaration of Rights is more value to the world and will do more good than all the laws and statutes that have yet been promulgated. In the Declaratory Exordium, which prefaces the Declaration of Rights, we see the solemn and majestic spectacle of a nation opening its commission under the auspices of its Creator to establish a government, a scene so new and so transcendentally unequaled by anything in the European world that the name of a revolution is diminutive of its character, and it rises into a regeneration of man. What are the present governments of Europe but a scene of inequity and oppression? What is that of England? Do not its own inhabitants say it is marked where every man has his price, and where corruption is common traffic at the expense of a deluded people? No wonder, then, that the French Revolution is traduced. Had it confined itself merely to the destruction of flagrant despotism, perhaps Mr. Burke and some others had been silent. Their cry now is, it has gone too far. That is, it has gone too far for them. It stares corruption in the face, and the venal tribe are all alarmed. Their fear discovers itself in their outrage, and they are but publishing the groans of a wounded vice But from such oppression, the French Revolution, instead of suffering, receives an homage. The more it is struck, the more sparks it will emit. And the fear is it will not be struck enough. It has nothing to dread from attacks. Truth has given it an establishment, and time will record it with a name as lasting as his own. Having now traced the progress of the French Revolution through most of its principal stages, from its commencement to the taking of the Bastille and its establishment by the Declaration of Rights, I will close the subject with the energetic apostrophe of M. de Lafayette. Quote, "May this great monument raised to liberty serve as a lesson to the oppressor and an example to the oppressed." End quote. So there you have a sizable piece of Thomas Paine's Rights of Man. What I read was part of the beginning and then his later commentary after we read through those rights. And I think what's interesting, in 1791, you know, not too far after the 1776, right, the formation of the United States of America, the French Revolution and all of these things, you know, there's a Masonic kind of weaving in and out of things. And we see a lot of the virtues that Freemasonry espouses contained right here within that book and many other books like it. I think Freemasonry really does kind of inform how governments should work and things, which is interesting, right? Because this is why people think we're behind everything, maybe because we have Masonic tenets contained within our statutes, our laws, our constitutions, our declarations. And chief among them, I suppose, would be this idea of equality, justice, truth. So if that book interests you, I really hope you check it out. You can pretty much get them anywhere. It's available freely online. In the show notes, I'll put a link to the copy that I have, which I actually got from a secondhand bookstore, but is in pristine condition. I got it for just $20. It was great. But you can buy this this text anywhere for just a couple dollars in paperback, or you can, of course, download, you know, a PDF of it, or just read it on the internet. I mean, it's from 1791, so no copyright there. And arguably, truth has no copyright. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. I would urge you to check out the website WCY Podcast for all things about this show, other projects that we're working with. I also want to urge everybody out there to please check out a new podcast that we just released called Masonic Readers Podcast, which is a book club podcast based on book clubs, really. I got together with Adam Thayer. We decided to both read Laudable Pursuit and tackle each part of the book. I would normally say chapters, but Laudable Pursuit has parts. So each episode is one part, and we cover that. So the idea is you pick up the book and you read chapter one or part one. You listen to part one. You read part two. You listen to part two. And we've got season. This is a podcast that'll be released in season. So season one is Laudable Pursuit. You can pick it up on our website at MasonicReaders.com. We have links there to get it from Chris's Lulu Press in print. You can get it on Audible, or you can get a free PDF right there on the website, so you can read along and check out the podcast. It's totally free. I hope you guys check that out. We had a lot of fun doing it. It's a little bit more fun, conversational. We have some jokes. We laugh. We say some controversial things, not unlike the book. But I hope you guys check it out and enjoy it. If nothing else, it's some additional Masonic content for you in these rough times where we've got nothing but time on our hands, it seems like, even though things are starting to get back to normal. And lastly, please check out MasonicLegacySociety.com, where you can download a free guide and document that will enable you to transform yourself. That is an invitation to all, not just Masons, profane and Mason alike. You can hear more about Masonic Legacy Society in last week's episode of the podcast, episode number 448 with Akram Elias. That's it for this week. I can't thank you enough for joining me. Thank you to our producers, our fellows, our contributors, whether on Patreon or PayPal. I love you guys all. Thank you for making this show happen week after week. I know everybody out there who listens to the show thanks you also. It is a tremendous, tremendous gift that you guys have all done. So thanks again. If you want to learn how to become a contributor, fellow producer, head on over to WCYpodcast.com. You can reach me at WCYpodcast@gmail.com for any questions, comments, concerns. You can hit me up on Facebook, all these places. I'm everywhere and always pretty much available. So thank you very much. We'll talk to you all next week. Stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.